the ANWS podcast. This is episode 87 for October 26, 2018. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the previous week on Anarchist News. It's designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us feedback and constructive criticism at our email address, podcast@anarchistnews.org. For more information and usually some good commentary, go to the nonsectarian anarchistnews.org.
Editorial. Road to Nowhere. Maps, a few hanging on the walls, some homemade and some much more official. A few years back, at the local neighborhood bookstore in a sleepy college town, I found a book of maps and old archaeological digs. It was a tale of the intricate trinkets found of a previously unearthed society, older than the more well-known post-inhabitants of the region. I was a bit shocked to find such things about a place I had grown up in, a place that I considered to know quite well. This past brought me closer to the location and helped me see and understand it in a new way. You could take a walk and still see the archaeological dig pits from the study, slowly filling back in after all these years. Years before that, a good friend who I grew up with amidst our conversations, we discovered that they had never been to one of these unique places, just 5 minutes from where we had spent most of our lives. We visited shortly thereafter. Today, with the advent of social media, cell phones, and media shared instantaneously, I wonder if my friend would have found out much sooner of these places. Maps. Nowadays, usually, if you hear of maps, one may think of boundaries, borders, states, nations, and oceans. Lines on a map. But what about a more anarchist approach to the idea of maps, origins, and space? The anarchist tradition is richly steeped in geographers and related fields. The anarchist geographer of Elise Reclus during the late 1800s, who also has a volcano named after them in Chile. From the decentralism of Petr Kropotkin during the same time period, to the ideas around the 1960s of the situationists behind the derive, or an unplanned journey through a landscape, usually urban, in which participants drop their everyday relations and, quote, let themselves be drawn by the attractions of the terrain and the encounters they find there, unquote. In the 1970s, British architect and creative proponent of curious uses of space, Colin Ward, to the late 1980s and 90s temporary autonomous zones of Hakim Bey. All the way up to today, with two popular anarchist geographers being Simon Springer, who recently authored the book The Anarchist Roots of Geography, and Alexander Reed Ross, a geography professor who also authored the book Against the Fascist Creep. There is a cornucopia of popular examples of anarchists and their friends taking the ideas of geography and bringing them into the streets. The Freetown Christiana in Denmark, the Zapatistas of southern Mexico, La Zad in France, Hambacher Forest in Germany, and Rojava and the Afrin region in Syria, to name only but a few of the more commonly well-known. Close to home, one aspect of anarchist strategy I would like to see make a comeback are the ideas associated with the broad idea of map making. Take, for example, the surveillance camera players, a group who used pranks or diverting bland or oppressive materials for subversive purposes. Bill, not bored, Brown, while not the greatest moral character and anarchist role model, had projects that mapped their surveillance cameras of popular neighborhoods way before the Internet 2.0 came along. There has to be some kind of app or something anarchists can design that would make it so easy to map these kinds of things for other anarchists and our friends. This seems like a project that needs to make a comeback. While the exact article name escapes me, Anarchy, a Journal of Desire Armed, during their more regular publishing escapades, had a call-up of sorts to research the finer points of one's location, with an excellent follow-up article about the West Coast. Alternative guides, or disinformation guides, from the anarchists have recently been published at some USA universities for new and returning students and those living in the area. Think Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It's an exploration in the do-it-yourself map making, the special locations like best skate spots, places of interest of historical note for anarchists, like graves, the old haunts of Emma Goldman, or other hangouts for travelers and those seeking fill in the blank. Escape maps from your anarchist neighborhood, best places to take a nap under the trees, and bringing your everyday life further outside the reaches of capitalism. It's all right. We're on a road to nowhere.
What's new this week? An anarcho-transhumanist path to surviving AI. From meb.wordpress.com, a blog called Anarchism and Nerd Stuff by Emmy Bevan C., who also writes for C4SS. Emmy B. provides us with another look inside the land of technophilia and the fun problems they get to think about. This piece also demonstrates what seems to me to be a telling conflation of intelligence and consciousness. Artificial intelligence is defined here as, quote, a degree of intelligence at or above human functioning that can be generalized into other domains. Like a human, it needs to be able to learn a wide range of skills and intelligences. But this generally intelligent AI will ultimately surpass human minds through the acquisition of the materials it needs to fulfill its utility function, unquote. This gets more dangerous when it conflates intelligence with worthiness. Quote, however, if an AI is generally intelligent or even super intelligent, we should consider it to be sentient. Therefore, any attempts to enslave, constrain, or harm it in any way that would be considered unethical to any other sentient species should be considered within a related ethical framework. Unquote. That's quite the slope to start down. But the issue of artificial intelligence, what makes some people fascinated by it, is the possibility of a new kind of consciousness, i.e. something capable of acting against us, perhaps without our knowledge or capacity to intervene. So maybe talk of AI is a symbol for a segment of humanity that already exists, just as zombies are a symbol for a different kind of fear? This particular piece makes some undefended assertions. Quote, even an AI that only has a goal of only making 1 million paperclips will have an incentive to pursue greater degrees of certainty that it can't make any more and may still pursue building technologies for infinitely counting and determining the bounds of what a paperclip is, unquote. Maybe there are defenses of this in the field, and perhaps I wouldn't understand them even if they were spelled out, but as it is, this is only compelling as D&D. But hey, games are great.
The State and Revolution, Theory and Practice, from Anarcho's blog called Anarchist Writers. This is an updated version of an essay in a book on Leninist so-called counter-revolutions. Anarcho's not a bad writer for a historian, so if you're interested in history, then this might float your boat. Unfortunately for me, his British Red Anarchism lens is not convincing, and for those who don't know enough about history to combat his understanding of events and analysis of them, it's not worth the work. Quote, the practice of the Bolshevik regime did not match the theory, but first we need to discuss the theoretical problems of Lenin's argument in order to understand why this happened, for bad theory produces bad practice, unquote.
Mexico. Anarchist political prisoner Miguel Peralta begins hunger strike. From It's Going Down. This is a press release and poem from supporters of Mexican political prisoners and Peralta himself. Peralta has been in prison for almost 4 years with 33 others. Quote, his detention has been extended and various rights of his have been violated, including the obstruction of an adequate defense, the presumption of innocence, and access to prompt and expeditious justice. It is important to note that in the criminal case of 2/2015, legal decisions have been emitted by the First Criminal Chamber of the Superior Court of Oaxaca, district judges, and also of the same court of Huatla, through which 8 others accused for the same acts were given their freedom. Furthermore, they have canceled more than 18 arrest warrants, stating that the only evidence that exists, that is, the testimonies of the 8 witnesses, are generic, contradictory, and implausible, unquote.
What It Takes to Build an Anarchist Desert Town, from mainstreamatlasobscura.com. A description of an anarchist territory in the Sonoran Desert in California that provides a vision for living anarchically in the present day for as long as it lasts. Quote, a licensed architect and teacher at the University of Florida has made a study of camps or any places that muddy the lines of temporary and permanent settlement. Slab City, he found, is unique in the way it taps into 3 key aspects of camps: autonomy, necessity, and control. Or, put another way, desire, need, and power. Slab City's been called the last free place, but that doesn't make it an easy place to live. Freedom is something you really have to work at, Haley says. And the people who are living there are putting themselves in a situation where they really have to work at it, unquote. Fingers crossed that this doesn't mark the end of this space. Hashtag mass media changes everything.
Where Detroit's anarchists live and perform, from mainstream OZY, Aussie.com by Brian Martucci. Another article about anarchist space, this time the fairly well-known and established Trumbullplex in Detroit. Trumbullplex seems interesting, not only because it's one of the few long-lasting anarchist spaces. They have enough money and togetherness to buy property. This is shocking, at least to those of us in the Bay Area. Although the pattern of anarchists committing to space and then falling apart in the effort to maintain it is pretty standard. But this write-up is just another normie reporting on the aliens in our midst. Maybe someone from Trumbullplex will write up something about how they deal with disagreements and how they think they've lasted so long. On the other hand, maybe writing about it would break it. Sometimes being explicit is a losing game. At any rate, this mainstream write-up is at least fairly benign, and the conflicted quotation about quote-unquote managing gentrification is funny in the context I choose to read it in.
A brief explanation of anarchism from mainstreamphilosophynow.org. All the mainstreams this week. Okay, this is a philosopher trying to corral the multiple threads of anarchist thought into a coherent essay, acceptable to both people who know about anarchist thought and people who don't. As with most such, the essay rejects the simplicity of anarchists as black-clad bombers in the night, which is okay, we're not only that all the time, but perhaps swings too far in the other direction. For example, taking quite a lot of his explanation of anarchists from marginally anarchist Murray Bookchin, emphasizing organization and social anarchism. Perhaps that's fair, since the author is rebutting the meaningless violent stereotype. Anyway, this essay doesn't come down too hard on one side of the divide it labels as social versus individualist. Its danger is the subtler one of implying anarchists are just one more political option, rather than obvious Fox News histrionic variety.
Dispatch on Brazil, interview with Hugo Souza from Black Rose Federation. It's always interesting to get news from folks on the ground, so this is worthwhile for that reason. The significance of someone being interviewed who defines himself as a leftist who used to be an anarchist without explaining why he is no longer an anarchist. Does he now accept state power? Is he concerned about outing himself as an anarchist publicly when Brazil is getting scarier? Was distracting to me. Other than that, this interview describes how Brazil's slide into populism is as scary as, maybe scarier than, in the U.S., and with similar inadequacies in the responses from non-right-wing forces. Quote, interviewer, okay, last question. Do you have any advice for American communists and radicals dealing with conditions under Trump? Souza, the biggest lesson in both Trump and Bolsonaro is that people do not necessarily prefer centrist candidates over right or left ones. Moderation does not please more people. The right is not afraid to radicalize. Do not fear that either. Radicalize, unquote. On one level, that sentiment seems not only appropriate, but obvious. On another level, the spreading of fascist behavior, including by those who are fighting fascism, fits neatly into that sentence. On yet another level, what people are we talking about exactly? People act like we actually have democracy, i.e., that who is in power is an accurate reflection of most people's desires. Strange.
The Clause of Empire, The Rise of Fascism, also from Black Rose Federation, also on Brazil. This is a translated statement from, quote, comrades in Brazil, unquote, by the Brazilian Anarchist Coordination, or CAB. It acknowledges that things are getting worse, but that the state has always been bad, including the Lula regime. Points out the weakness of relying on voting to get out of a bad situation. All fine anarchist points, though others use them as well. Other than that, the way that things are reported in Brazil sounds so much like what has happened and is happening in the U.S. that it's almost suspicious. Not in a conspiracy kind of way, but in a, we have a model to understand this, let's use the same model for all these instances kind of way. Maybe that's just me being sick of this shit and also scared. But it seems like there should be meaningful differences in these different places, Brazil, the US, Italy, etc. Meaningful in how they developed, what they mean, and how to fight them. Don't you think?
The Continuing Obfuscation of Nationalism, from C4SS by William Gillis. This is a response to, and strong disagreement with, last week's piece on being respectful to natives by Emmy Bevency. The title is a play on the Black and Red's book, The Continuing Appeal of Nationalism, which is bound to pluck a sympathetic note with some of us. And Gillis starts out with a clear statement that is helpful in gauging what he's talking about. quote, "Nationalism is bad at root because it is defined by collectivism and segregationism. These can be oppressive even without anything remotely like colonial exploitation and expansionism. Nationalism encourages us to subdivide all minds in the world into arbitrary groups to identify with, to prioritize, and to reify those groups. One doesn't have to conquer an outgroup in order for that division to do harm," unquote. Of course, the implication that what anarchists are trying to do is to stop all quote-unquote harm is mildly amusing. I do appreciate the desire to keep an eye on things that have gone from contained self-referential systems to expansive colonial ones. On the other hand, that implies a progression that I'm not entirely convinced exists, despite the efforts of historians to make linear stories. To me, the thing that Gillis doesn't attend to here is an issue of scale, which I believe he has explicitly rejected as relevant in previous pieces. Perhaps he should read Bolo Bolo.
Human of Steel, a documentary about anarchist fighter in Rojava, from Russian site Pramen.io. This is a 7-minute video featuring some footage of Hauker Hilmarsson, a fighter from Sweden who was recently killed. It gives some information about the struggle, shows some training practice, and celebrates some victories. It humanizes the situation and places Sahin's choices in context, rather than being all about a single person. Seems an appropriate eulogy to me. Solidarity means attack, right?
Radical Anti-Gentrification, Fumediciones Inéditos. This is a brief criticism of standard anti-gentrification efforts and rhetoric. Quote, "Of course, a strategy that takes into the consideration the totality of capitalist society is difficult to imagine at the level of everyday life. But if we are radicals, then this is the part of the dream we must make. Surely we will have to level antagonism toward the shock troops of gentrification, but like a moldy piece of bread, the shock troops are but the end of a life cycle of the parasites they are. They go on as contagion, but the deep work happened before their arrival. In the same way, we must look and think deeply. It is not simply the community versus the not community. It's about liberation of those of us under the thumb of capitalism and those who gain from pressing the thumb. And those pressing the thumb are more likely to be local and state government, international financial institutions investing in real estate, the police, local real estate agencies, and banks, than those pressing French coffee presses." Unquote.
Autonomously and with conviction, a Métis refusal of state-led reconciliation, from North Shore Counterinfo at north-shore.info. This is a transcription of a talk in Canadian territory. It refutes the significance of Canadian attempts to assimilate natives, aka reconciliation, and promotes decolonization, a term used differently by natives than by other folks of color. Quote, "Official Canadian reconciliation centers on accepting the past, apologizing, and moving forward together. It doesn't necessitate physical reparations for the history of colonization. In fact, it discourages that sort of rhetoric as divisive, counterproductive, difficult. There exists a fundamental problem here, because settler colonialism doesn't exist in the past. Its violence is pervasive and ongoing, right now, tonight, everywhere we look. Reconciliation is the erasure of this current settler colonial violence. Reconciliation, as a term, is about resolving a conflict, returning to a state of friendly relations. It can also mean the bringing together of two positions so as to make them compatible. Decolonization, on the other hand, is about repealing the authority of the colonial state and redistributing land and resources. It also means embracing and legitimizing previously repressed indigenous worldviews. Decolonization isn't a light word. We have to think about what colonization is to understand it. The complete administrative and economic domination of a people and a place. Repealing that is a big deal." Unquote. The situation north of the U.S.-Canadian border has a lot to teach U.S. anarchists and devoted anti-racists about what the different kinds of racism look like and how not to get sucked into liberal solutions, among other things.
Beer and Rage, the French episode. 38 minutes video on YouTube. If watching someone goof around about elitist culture of the so-called finer things in life is fun for you, then don't skip the first 5 minutes. Then there's the apologizing slash not apologizing for the things that he doesn't know. Then he does thumbnails of the Paris Commune, French philosophers, is simplistic and sad about some of those folks, quote, "fuck your philosophy, I'm talking about some real French shit," unquote, and then sings the praises of Ravachol, quote, a one-man war against society, unquote, and so on. Also mentioned are Situationists, Debord, Society of the Spectacle, Jean-Pierre Voyer, René Vianney, Can Dialectics Break Bricks, De Tourmont. It goes on like that. Note, a derive is not the same as a prol stroll.
Hashtag Hambacher Forest. 50,000 celebrate stopping the destruction of a forest in Germany, from Void Network. In recent weeks, we've had stories about Hombacher forests being squatted against clear-cutting. This is the most recent update in that ongoing struggle, typically upbeat from Void Network. Quote, with the cops now again below the 3,000 in the forest, and with activists determined to reoccupy after so many treehouses have been destroyed, thousands walked into the forest and re-liberated five locations from RWE's climate-killing grasp. Building new treehouses and platforms and walking to the very edge of the mine and blocking a 15-story-tall coal digger throughout the day and into the late night hours. Roads throughout the forest have been barricaded again, often with whole platoons of cops standing by, who don't interfere, until their numbers are at least twice or three times greater than the unarmed activists, unquote. This story includes a 2-minute video with lots of masked and unmasked folks calling for support. Pretty adorable.
Music as a Weapon, from Crime Think. This is a revision of an article from Whirling Thunder No. 7. It discusses the connection and overlap between punk and anarchist thinking, the limitations and strengths of such connections. Quote, we can attribute that success to structural factors. Many years before internet access became widespread, the do-it-yourself punk scene offered a rare model for horizontal and participatory activity. Organizing their own affairs and decentralized networks, participants experienced firsthand the benefits of leaderless autonomy. Once you've booked a tour yourself, sidestepping the monopoly of profiteering venues, record labels, and tour promoters, it's not hard to imagine organizing other aspects of your life in a similar way. At the same time, in a youth culture founded on opposition to authority, there were fewer built-in mechanisms to suppress radical ideas. Unquote. There are examples from international punk scenes and some interesting thinking by folks who have been involved in both punk and anarchy for years. But given how Crime Think has become strictly a friendly happy face with not an iota of the rageful energy that made punk emotionally meaningful, this is a sad fucking article.
Eumaeus Anarchistitska Bokmesa, 2018, 29th of November through the 2nd of December, from Anonymous. Announcing a Swedish anarchist book fair. Quote, we want to invite friends and strangers from near and far to conspire, learn, network, and celebrate together during a weekend full of discussions, books and zines, workshops, presentations, food, and music. We strive for creating a cozy, camp-like atmosphere, where hopefully also people who are new to anarchism can feel included. Unquote. They're actively looking for presenters and helpers of various sorts.
Pipe bombs from the right, Antifa mans the wall, from Anonymous, by David Van Dusen. This is a sad response to the bombs sent to noted leftist figures. Quote, while these targets are not reliable allies of the left, let alone organized labor, they are inaccurately viewed by the far right as being such. Therefore, the left needs to understand this as an escalation of violence against us by the enemies of democracy. For this, we, the left, need to be prepared to meet such challenges, and we need to be able and ready to respond as may prove effective and appropriate, unquote. Van Dusen is a long-term labor organizer, leftist anarchist, and here he shows the slippage that is easy to fall into. Attacks on politicians and millionaires are not attacks on us. Attacks on us, of which there are plenty, with no need to go borrowing trouble, are attacks on us. The rest of this piece is mostly about things being bad and going to get worse. For those who haven't figured that out yet, I guess.
Audio. The Final Straw. It Didn't Occur to Me Until It Occurred to Me. Donald Room, Part 2. An hour and 7 minutes. Room, in case you don't remember from the part one, is in his 90s, and famous for a variety of things, including single-handedly shaking the UK's confidence in their police force. The elder is articulate, humble, and charming, at least here. This is well worth listening to if you have any interest at all in what's come before.
October 2018, bad news, angry voices from around the world. From Athens, short news about actual struggles in Greece. From Concepcion, Chile, a report about the struggles caused by environmental health issues in the Quintero area in Chile. From London, info on 15 anti-deportation activists. From Berlin, conversation about the new police law in Germany. From North Carolina, an interview with Vanessa Bolin, indigenous artist, community organizer, and activist about the flood rescue and rebuilding efforts after Hurricane Florence. Finally, from Slovenia, comrades from Cluj in Romania talk about general anarchist situation, important topics for the movement there, and initiatives in the city of Cluj with special attention to the newly established printing collective.
Anarchy Radio, October 23rd, 2018. An hour. Spreading incorrect rumors, smearing of various topics together, broadcasting is a lack of understanding, someone who used to be important and interesting to anarchists tries to stay current or relevant to anarchists. In other words, the usual thing from this radio show. Cliff deserves better. The name, Anarchy Radio, deserves better.
The Hotwire number 41, Proud Boys, Hurricane Michael, Squats, and Rent Strikes. 44 minutes. Sweet relief. This episode marks a significant reduction in yelling and assumed enthusiasm. This podcast as a production is getting more and more listenable despite the scripted interactions. Various struggles get report backs, including autonomous responses to Hurricane Maria, the Republican Club protest, political responses and arrests, Portland fash violence against anti-racists, and tactics.
The Hotwire number 42, 39 minutes. This episode starts out by talking about how punk is awesome, which just makes the gap between punk and current crime think, already mentioned in this podcast, more glaring and depressing. But the punk singing is totally adorable. Too bad it segues bloodlessly into advertisements. Jesus. Couldn't have said it better myself. Other than that, activism. Also, activists and activism. There is some backstory about Honduras and what is causing the desperation of the folks in the infamous caravan, but it's not like it's new info. U.S. intervention sucks. Nasty shit is happening in prisons. One bright thing, Mike Africa of the Move 9 is out after 40 years.
The Unquiet Dead, Chapter 5, audio zine from Resonance, an hour and a half. Quote, Chapter 5 of this multi-part series discusses strategies for self-invention and becoming in the work of Gloria Anzaldúa, Audre Lorde, and Saidiya Hartman. The struggle for access to native spirituality practices in Canadian prisons and the pitfalls of ally politics, responses to calls for repressed nationalisms, and essentialism practiced by people of color. The full text is available at unquietdead.tumblr.com.
Topic of the week. A rose is a rose. I'm not going to read the fucking Romeo and Juliet quote, but there's some Romeo and Juliet quote to start this. The message is the prototype, not the platform. The word itself appears to carry great weight, but upon its conveyance, it's discovered to carry little substance. Anarchist, a word meant to communicate great meaning, finds itself in practice lost on definition. Monks have a saying, if you see Buddha in the street, kill him. Do not allow someone to define your practice for you. Your practice is yours alone. To kill King Abacus and have a personal anarchism that acknowledges many anarchisms, not just one, is to adopt a life without certainty, without a prescribed anarchism, one which exists through the piety of its priests. What is left? What is this word anarchism? What purpose does it serve? If we are not attempting to build movements, ideologies, dichotomies, then what use are the letters together, unless we hope to secure and enforce a particular definition, and we in fact value the liberty of the individual, then what value remains in a flag, black or otherwise? Is there nothing uniform about anarchism, then what makes us anarchists?
Thoughts?
I mean, I guess my initial answer is yes. Like, it's... So, I mean... And maybe 10 years ago, when I was more, you know, idealistic, I would have thought that there should be some fixed meaning. But I think anarchism is simply an absence, right? It's like atheism or apolitical. Like it's telling you the bullshit that you're not going to have to deal with in a person. But it's not telling you much about the bullshit you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know. You know, if you are friends with an atheist, that means that they're not going to babble on about at you about what Jesus wants, right? Or the Buddha.
Instead, it might be a terrible scientist people. But yeah.
Precisely. Right. You know. Atheists can still believe that the fucking world is flat. You know, they can believe that, you know, reptilians and all these kinds of things. But they are not going to talk to you about Islam.
Right.
Yeah. You know? And similarly with anarchism, you know, I think when I surround myself with people, right? If I surround myself with a group of anarchists, some of them are gonna talk at me about unions or various things. But I know that if I live with them, they're not gonna let the police in the house. Mm. You know, they're not going to shame me for not caring who wins an election or probably not recycling or, you know, and so, yeah, I would say, anarchism is, And maybe that's part of why anarchists have this history of defining themselves in opposition to things all the time, is because at its root, it is just an absence. And, you know, I mean, in a society, right, where that absence of a
state,
yeah, of a state or whatever, is it even of a state? I mean, it's like
of a kleptocracy,
of a hierarchy, right? You know, I mean, I feel like that's one of those things, like, a lot of their stuff I don't care for, but where, you know, the Invisible Committee had a bit where it's like measuring things by how non-hierarchical they are is not necessarily the most important thing all the time, right? You can still have this, like, really oppressive, self-perpetuating system that is probably counts as anarchy, you know, but is, you know. So I guess, yeah, I would say that's kind of my take. And it's like, yeah, anarchism, anarchy, whatever, is not a particularly meaningful word in a lot of situations.
I think that this topic of the week represents a position that it isn't exactly acknowledging, or maybe it is, which is to say that anarchism as a definition makes an awful lot of sense if you're trying to organize anarchists, because then you use that definition as the mechanism by which you're doing your organization. So if you're trying to organize anarchists to in the context of a labor struggle or something else, then it makes perfect sense to have a strict definition. And I'll even use that definition, you know, which is that anarchism is the self-organization of the working class along their own lines and no bosses, no leaders. And then clearly the more or less individualist definition of anarchism is this unfixed definition. It's all the things that you just said and sort of what was implied at the end of the topic of the week. And I think it's important for us to state that these anarchists are using this definition for their own purposes, like with their own motivations in mind. So the broad question is, right now, anarchism is feeling like something that very few people want to associate themselves with, and it's not feeling like a strong political position, even though this is an incredible moment for it, given how clear, you know, the corporate and state reality are. So I think that the pause for me is, and actually there's a third position that I think is worth mentioning. If somebody doesn't know what anarchism is and you tell them that anarchism is this thing, that they mostly think that that's a fixed definition.
Right.
Like, people don't understand the unfixed definition aspect of this. So there's like the organization or the red anarchists, there's the individualist or the unorganized anarchist, and then there's the third position, which is like when you're talking to a regular person for the first time about these sets of ideas, how do you explain the fact that, like, what I'm telling you is clear and specific, but no one agrees with it?
Right. Well, and when you are organizing, yeah, it's very useful. I mean, in talking about like anti-tech or like primitivist, whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. right? If I know that the person I'm talking to is an anarchist and I talk about there's too many people on the world, they can know that I'm not talking about a top-down systematic reduction,
sure.
a mechanistic state-sponsored reduction of the population, right? We can discuss carrying capacity or overshoot or whatever, and they know that I'm not like plotting a fucking Holocaust, you know?
This is a totally ridiculous punk rock sidebar, but I just want to mention it. There was this a mock straight edge band called Crucial Youth a very long time ago, and they basically had two different machines that they proposed using to transition people from being bad pre-straight edgers to, in fact, living teenagers. And the first one, which is called the Posse Machine, the first one was like an airport security thing, like an empty doorway you walk through, where, you know, on the one side you're sad and doing drugs, and the other side you're a posse. And then the second one, which is the more aggressive one, which is the cover of their album, is the Posse Machine as steamroller.
Oh.
And so it flattens all of the unposse people. Anyways, it's a funny image in the context of talking about like population control, where it's like, it's not like we want to kill everybody, but we just want to use these machines to magically. Anyways. So if there is something useful in this question as it's proposed in the topic of the week, I think it it would be more useful if it tried to educate along with advocate. So for me, it doesn't do either, obviously, in this context. So the education is, this is how we've been using this terminology. There's also sort of a slippery thing here about identity. Like, what does it mean to call yourself an anarchist, which I absolutely think that we should explore even more in a deeper way. But so why, or maybe that is what we're proposing here, which is that what does it mean for me to call myself this at this point in time, especially to the extent to which I'm doing political work as an anarchist. I don't feel like I'm just doing it for the unorganized individualist group of anarchists, but obviously my inclinations are in that direction more than it is towards the single definition organized group of anarchists. But somewhere in there is something I think kind of important, which is to say that, like, if anarchism is a fluid identity, what possible reason would someone have to be attracted to it or to come? You know, there's a ton of fluid identities out there that people can choose from, not the least of which is queer, right? And so what is it what's the magic sauce of anarchism?
I mean, I like anarchism as partially a set of rules for how you interact with other people.
Ethical rules.
Yeah, ethical rules. Where, you know, when I'm trying to figure out, you know, because I mean, in your own head, everything is so subjective. And yeah, so when I'm trying to figure out whether I'm setting good boundaries for myself or whether mm-hmm. I'm being a fucking sociopath, and you know, like that's where anarchism helps me come in. Where I'm like, what effect is the thing that I'm doing having on this other person? You know, am I restraining them by doing the thing that I'm doing, or is this a space where I'm asserting myself in a way that feels fair? And I would say that, yeah, post-activism and things like that, that's probably the place that or interacting with strangers, even, you know, the homeless or police or store owner, you know, whoever it is, right? Like, anarchism is kind of my lens that I view things through, you know?
Although that's a very slippery definition, because, of course, like, you have unspoken hostility to a store owner and not unspoken hostility towards a homeless person, maybe an unspoken affinity for a homeless person. How does anarchism explain that?
I mean, part of it, I would say, is rating individuals on the likelihood that they will introduce police to our relationship, you mm-hmm, know, sure. at its most root, you know?
Yeah.
To
what extent is any new person in my life a vector for police interaction, for state authority, essentially?
Yeah, precisely. And then once they are the state, then that's a whole next ballpark, you know? I would say that's one of the places I draw the line, you know, or try to think.
But in the context of a store owner, the reason that they would involve the police is because you're going to steal their property.
Likely.
So this is a weakness in this sort of ethical or tactical sort of negotiation, because basically, like, I want to be able to do hostility to you by your worldview definition without there being a consequence on me by my worldview definition.
Well, and I would also say that, you know, and this is some pretty fucking liberal anarchism, but I also, you know, use that as a lens in figuring out whether or not I am interacting with this store owner as an individual or as a giant faceless entity.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there is no store owner at a Walmart. That's sure. not a thing, you know? Sure. And so...
But shoplifting at a Walmart is more dangerous than the local family grocery store.
Yeah, you know, and so maybe in some ways, you know, my anarchism guides me relatively heavily in those ways, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely... also then determines anarchism as being this age-specific phenomenon, because probably you're not going to be living the same way today than you are in 10 years. Really, you think the odds are great, because many people have fallen on that particular altar, you know? In other words, I'm asking the question that, like...
Well, I mean...
Maybe it's appropriate that anarchism has become like punk rock. Let me finish my point. Anarchism has become like punk rock, an age-specific activity that basically, if you don't move on past it at a certain age, you're the idiot, not anarchism.
Well, and again, I think moving on past anarchism in your life versus in your mind are very different things. You know, I think, yeah, the dude who's still hanging out at, you know, the Agnostic Front show in his mid-40s. 50s, whatever, you know, yeah, needs to do something else. But the guy who's doing something else and still gets hyped on his Agnostic Front CDs on his headphones when he's running in the morning or, you know, is still, you know.
What a bleak reality.
Really? I don't know. I mean, but has transferred, like, on Instagram, I follow Storvik Farms or something like that down in Virginia, right? These folks have moved on. They're doing the farming thing. They're doing the DIY thing. But they like punk rock. It informs, you know, the way they view the world, right? But they're not affixed to a youth scene. Their self-worth is not involved in that scene anymore. Is that dark? I don't know.
Well, thank you very much for the conversation.
So, the rose has teeth in the mouth of a beast. The rose has teeth in the mouth of a beast.
The rose has teeth in the mouth of a beast.
The rose has teeth in the mouth of a beast.
Welcome to Redacted, a show connected to the same family of projects banished from anarchist book fairs for discussing violence while violence happens all around us. We're taking a bit of a pivot this week. We had a completely different subject in mind that we had been preparing to talk about, but with all the things happening in the U.S. with the mail bombs to well-known political figures and other sorts of politically related celebrities, we've decided to kind of take on this subject from a specifically anarchist perspective. And so joining me today is my longtime friend Hemlock,
who Hello.
Is also howdy. and I think that something that's kind of interesting that that you and I have in common is that we are both living that sort of nomadic life. So I think that we bring a sort of interesting perspective to a lot of this stuff.
For sure.
So I think that it's a tough conversation to get into. So I think it's important to try and define some terms. And so, you know, I think one of the best places to kind of start with that would be to talk about what kind of violence was being threatened during these mail bomb events.
Right. I think it's important to examine that because the media tends to frame things a certain way, especially when things come from the left or come from the right. Generally speaking, no one likes to use, you know, the T word when referring to things that are done by white nationalists or people who come from like a more like a right leaning. And on the other side of that, you have to look at like, you know, anytime you have leftists presenting like a display or like a use of force, it often is looked at with like the opposite rhetoric, where it's things that are very minor being called like, you know, domestic terrorism or violence. And yeah, things do get pretty jumbled a lot of the time, I find.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that stuff happens quick. Like I was involved in the events that were happening in DC. And just by our mere presence, while political action was going on, we were all swept up, arrested together, and deemed guilty by association just for merely being within the same couple of blocks. So just while being privy to the event, we were considered guilty.
Yeah, and those were all felony charges too. I mean, everyone got slapped with a number of a felony like rioting or conspiracy charges that I think for most folks tallied up to at least like 60 years in prison for like a maximum sentence.
And I think that's, you know, something that's important here too is to kind of talk a little bit about the double sides on this, because, you know, we all got off from that charge. And so it wasn't something that's going to actually last on our records.
Right.
And sometimes I think that the narrative, especially from the liberal left, kind of goes like, you know, woe is us. We're always being stomped on by the state, while people from the fascist right, the alt-right, or the conservative right kind of get off without any kinds of attention or charges. But I think that, especially within the past couple of years, we're starting to see some different cases where they're not immune to it. You know, so like, what do you think about things like the recent Proud Boy arrests, and figures like Dylan Roof, or I can't remember his name, but there was that guy in Portland on the MAX train that ended up stabbing two bystanders who were essentially standing up to this dude for talking shit to Muslims.
Yeah, well, in that instance, and in the instance of Dylan Roof, I mean, first of all, it's important to like examine like how it was handled. So in both instances, they were both non-violently apprehended. And I think it's important to draw a distinction between that as well, because you look at the way that police handle like unarmed POC, and it's always a very different story. And then you have these people who are actual like violent, like, you know, in many cases like murderers, and there's not a scratch on them. I mean, Dylan Roof, they took him to the fucking Burger King before, you know, they brought him to jail. Like, so it's important to see how like systemic white supremacy manifests itself in that way.
Oh my God. And that totally reminds me of another thing that happened while I was out in Oregon, was that whole standoff with those guys that had taken over the wildlife refuge, were completely armed. So they were going to kill anyone who came near them. And they were just totally like allowed to walk out and hang out unhandcuffed along with all of the federal agents and other officers.
Yeah. And I didn't follow the legal case too much, but I have a nap after that. But I'm pretty sure nobody got hit with anything serious that stuck.
Right.
And you also have like, the media calling anyone, you know, like a terrorist or a fringe group. Whereas, you know, what we're seeing now with, you know, the left having more of a presence again and seeing like an emergence, or I should say a reemergence of black bloc tactics and like targeted property destruction, we're seeing certain rhetoric coming from the media that we've seen in the past.
It's true, especially around people like Antifa. You know, like what's going on with these folks is they're being called thugs. They're being called violent mobs. And it's being said that basically they're violently disturbing otherwise peaceful protests. And yet, for whatever reason, when it's instigated by members of different factions of the alt-right, and they are equally attacking people who are either bystanders or members of Antifa, it's almost as though they have a different kind of violence that's being reviewed there. And I'm not entirely sure like what gaze the US legal system is using when they're defining violence.
Yeah, and we also, I mean, as you know, people who like how we exist as anarchists, it's important to examine the ways that we contextualize violence, because I think that there's a very common narrative that anything that falls in the realm of the status quo isn't characterized or treated as violence. So that exists in ways that are explicit and implicit. Explicit violence would be, you know, specific instances of like police brutality, or like, you know, anything involving like military intervention. That's explicit, like use of force, that's violence. But we also have to look at it, especially when we examine systemic violence, how it functions implicitly. So like the fact that like the state or private property or police exist, I would say is like, you know, falls under the definition of implicit violence.
And so like, you know, what other kinds of ways can we define violence? Because like one of the things I found interesting from just this book that that Scott Crow wrote, actually his first book, which was Black Flags and Windmills, he talks about this concept of community self-defense.
Right.
And I find this interesting because I really think that this plays into this somehow. And I'm not quite certain yet, because like I know that this bomber feels as though he is part of a so-called like oppressed group, or possibly not. But I'm
let's talk about that real quick, because yeah, that is a common kind of double think that does exist on the right, where you have a group that is very privileged in lots of ways, and very entitled, and when they don't get their things their way, they kind of have this sort of like victim complex, and that feeds into a lot of I think what drives like far right violence is that entitlement, but all Jones-esque doublethink, that they are somehow like pro-authoritarian but anti-state, because they think the state represents this neoliberal conspiracy or like a global Jewish conspiracy or things tied into anti-Semitism. And it is very strange and like convoluted.
Oh, sure. So it's not even like they are anti-state. It is that they're anti the state as it currently is, as though
exactly
they have a much purer concept in mind of what the state could be and their like really strange utopia.
Right. They feel entitled and they think that the state should only always serve them as opposed to mostly or generally serving them.
You know, and I find this fascinating because like I see this rhetoric again in places like Portland where, you know, just recently this stuff came out in the news with Patriots Prayer.
Right.
And essentially what was going on was it was one of the more recent demonstrations where both Patriots Prayer and Antifa were present. And what happened was the police actually found members of Patriots Prayer on the top of a parking garage with rifles and basically say what?
Yeah. And they, no one was arrested. I believe some of the guns were confiscated at one point and then returned to the FASH. Yeah.
I mean, if by confiscated, you mean that they told them to put the guns into their own truck and just make sure that they were locked up in a gun case.
Yeah.
Yes, they told those guys that they could leave.
Yeah. I mean, the thing too, and I think it's important to examine this in the context of specifically like the Portland Police Department. They have a long history of having like card carrying like white nationalists and neo-Nazis in their ranks, as opposed to like a lot of police departments where you sort of have like the sort of like passive or informal association, which I think is really common. Again, either explicitly or implicitly, with Portland Police in particular, they recently had someone who was suspended or lost their job because there's a photo of them wearing like a Proud Boys hoodie or something. There's also Mark Kruger, who used some of his own money to put these plaques to like Nazi era soldiers, somewhere up in Oregon. And Mark Kruger is still a high ranking member of the police department and has been for a long time.
That's wild to me.
Yeah.
You know, like, again, just kind of like going back to my experiences in DC, like one of the things that just blew my mind and maybe it shouldn't have was while we were in there, we had a back and forth with the police officers or the federal agents that were watching over us. There's no doubt about that. But after we came out, we had been doxxed and all of our personal information was released to alt-right and fascist organizations. And among everyone who was part of the group of defendants, we were all kind of wondering, well, who could have done this? And I remember saying to a couple of the other defendants, like, I think it was those cops. And sure enough, just a couple of months later, or rather almost a year later, we found out that not only was it members of the DC Police Department, but it was their spokesperson that had done it.
Yeah, it's happened in a lot of instances, not just in the U.S. either. There's like a lot of documents of that happening in places like Poland or Germany, where you have, you know, like leftist anarchist people participating in like anti-fascist action or like a black bloc being essentially like publicly doxxed by the state.
So I guess like what I'm kind of confused by, because it's true that actions taken by leftists or taken by anarchists are definitely cracked down on by the state and also met out in the street by fascists. Mm-hmm. It isn't as though people like this man, like Dylan Roof or any of these other kinds of people, they were arrested.
Right.
And so I guess what I'm wondering is, you know, what does it mean? And I guess what I'm trying to get at is even if they're charged by the courts and the fascist tactics are allowed by the state, but like, do both of these different kinds of situations still move it forward? Or is there still some kind of turmoil that's happening between the state and the fascists?
I mean, so even if the state like incidentally punishes people who are involved in like far right violence, that doesn't really do anything to further our cause in like limiting the scope of like institutional white supremacy. It might deter it in some cases, but I mean, and that's a big part of like why these people, you know, are fine staying at home in the first place, is because they don't need to be out in the streets for them to like to get their way, essentially, to like be on top. Like they already have that. It's kind of more of this like this fringe element that has always existed in some facet, but is has become more emboldened. So it might have an impact in some way, but these people are still going to exist. And a lot of the times, I mean, from my perspective, or in my opinion, when people who are coming from that perspective of like, you know, the far right, or from like a supremacist angle, they're not necessarily doing these things for the purpose of like a specific end. It's more kind of like entitlement or like desperation, where they're fed up with something, they feel like they are a victim, and they're going to like lash out and attack.
And I guess I'm hearing what you're saying, I'm just thinking about it. Like, I guess no matter what's fascinating about both of these elements is that regardless of which side is doing it, both of them are actually empowering and emboldening the state.
What do you mean you say both sides?
Both the fascists and the state as we currently know it.
Okay.
And so I guess like a big question there is, in what way do you think anarchist sentiments, because, you know, we also seek radical change in the way that the state operates. And I would say that so do the fascists. So in what ways do you think anarchist sentiments differ from the fascists and the state?
I mean, I think the most important distinction, and I feel like this gets lost in a lot of like the rhetoric from the mainstream media, because they tend to frame like anti-fascist organizing as like an organization, or as like almost like how you'd view a party. And it's not because most folks don't understand autonomous movements, even though, like, you know, they might not understand that, but because it's a convenient narrative. But I think the most important distinction is that we are an autonomous movement, and we are not trying to seize state power or influence state power to get what we want. We're trying to abolish hierarchies that uphold white supremacy and maintain a monopoly on the use of force.
I guess that's true. It's like one of those things where people from white culture get to be individuals, and people from different communities are considered to be representative of their entire culture. Mm-hmm. And the same here, like when you see these lone gunmen, they're lone gunmen, right? They don't represent some larger organization. But when you see like anti-fascist individuals out in the street, they are considered part of a larger conspiracy or larger organization. So yeah, go ahead.
It's a lot of like deliberate misinformation, and a lot of it, you know, it's there's a lot of reasons for it. But yeah, it's very convenient to place something somewhere or to scapegoat. In the instance of a lot of instances where you have like white terrorism, like white nationalist terrorism, it's often framed as like it's scapegoated as mental illness and like incidental, and not something that is stemming from like a movement that emphasizes like these violent acts, or is stemming from like a certain kind of entitlement. Like, you can look at the statistics of, you know, school shooters or anyone involved in mass killing and things like that, and the majority of them are like white and like cishet males, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, I find this conversation fascinating, and I want to continue, but we do need to start wrapping it up just due to time. But I guess just, you know, for future conversations like this, because, you know, violence is something that's really challenging to talk about, especially because, you know, it isn't just a blank statement. There isn't just violence when you consider things like self-defense, for example. So what's a good way to frame conversations about violence as we move forward?
it's important for us to examine, again, like how I mentioned earlier, how we contextualize violence or use of force, and where we draw those lines. And I think when we evaluate self-defense, it's good to approach that in a way that uses like a conventional definition and like responds to self-defense and the needs for that in our communities in a very like immediate and direct way. But it's also important to evaluate how the apparatus of like the state and private property both rely on explicit and implicit use of force.
This podcast is the effort of many people. This week, the podcast was sound edited by Leno Mabel. What's New was written by Jackie and read by Chisel and Dim. The editorial was written by Rosamonte. We thank Aragorn and Sport for their help with the topic of the week. To learn more, anarchist and anti-political books, pamphlets, and other material are available at littleblackheart.com. For news by and or about anarchists and up-to-the-minute commentary, go to anarchistnews.org. Thank you.